You can rock it, you can roll it, you can stop and you can stroll it at the heart. When the record starts spinning, eucalypto with a chicken at the heart. Do the dance sensation, that sweeping coordination at the bop till you drop. Shake it till you break it. Bop till you drop.
Oh baby, shop for a top. Oh baby, flop with a cop. Oh baby, stop when you pop.
Use it or you lose it. Move it when you use it. Move it till you lose it. Come on and dance.
That was the Flirtations in a blend of two songs they often used to begin their live shows, Bop Till You Drop and At the Hop. They were a very gay a cappella singing group in New York City from 1988 to about 1997, with some member changes along the way. I'll get to that in a while. But the member I'm mainly concerned with for this show is Michael Callen. I've been wanting to do a tribute show to him for quite some time, but kept putting it off, as I consider his contributions to our music culture to be so significant. Tackling that has been a bit daunting, but for me, the time is right. You see, on my March show, I interviewed Pam Brandt to get the history of the band The Deadly Nightshade, and part of her history involved Michael. In the mid-80s, she, Michael, Richard Dworkin, and Jan Cleary were in probably the first mixed gay and lesbian band, calling themselves Lowlife. Of course, I have to mention right away that in addition to his music, Michael Callen is known for his work regarding AIDS. Wikipedia sums it up nicely this way. He was a significant architect of the response to the AIDS crisis in the United States. And he did that by helping to found several AIDS organizations, writing books and newspaper articles, appearing on television shows, and doing public speaking, which included testifying before the President's Commission on AIDS and both houses of Congress. But this is a music show, and I can map out Michael's career in about four stages, and there's some overlap. In the mid-80s was the band Lowlife. After that came some solo performing and cabaret work, and he also did some of that before Lowlife. In 1988 was the release of his solo LP, Purple Heart. Late 1987 saw the start of the group The Flirtations, which lasted past Michael's death in December of 1993. Finally, in 1996, an incredible posthumous double CD was released of work recorded before his death and mastered afterwards. That project was called Legacy. Okay, back to the band Lowlife. Before you hear about the band itself, I want to play some music. And from my interview with Deadly Nightshade member Pam Brandt, I have her talking about what I think was by far the band's most political song, one called Living in Wartime.
Well, that was an AIDS anthem. Michael wrote that. You know, the message is pretty clear. You know, more died every day. This is war. As gay people, we're living in wartime. Just a different kind of wartime. And it ended up being used in the Broadway play, Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart, which was new then. The play itself was not a musical. They took that recording. It was the music that they played as people were walking out of the theater. So it did end up being heard by the public, and not just on Michael's solo album.
This is no time for doubting.
about the group Low Life, such as how and why it was formed and what was unique about it.
Low Life was formed in early in 1982. Well, actually in the middle of 1982, I think. And it was shortly after a gay man named Michael Callan, who became an AIDS activist, was first diagnosed with a very small group of gay men. And by the time I met him, he had decided that gay men had a lot to learn from gay women in terms of incorporating political thinking into your personal life. So thinking it was also time for gay men and women to work together, he put an ad in the Village Voice saying he was looking to put together a band of gay men and women, a rock band. I answered his ad because I also was looking to put together a band that was equal band, where I had creative input, the other people had creative input.
I'm going to pause Pam's telling of the story at this point, because when I was editing her interview, I remembered that I had done an interview a few years ago with Richard Dworkin, who is a very talented drummer. We had talked about the many areas of our music history he had touched, such as also working with Blackberry, Buena Vista, Stephen Grossman, and Doug Stevens in the Outband. But I never had a chance to use this section where he talks about Low Life.
I met Michael in June of 1982. And the way I met Michael was I answered an ad for gay musicians that appeared in the New York Native, a gay newspaper. And Michael said, well, I happen to be getting together with a bass player tonight, so why don't you come over? So I rode my bike up to the West Village, went up to Mike's apartment on Jones Street, and there was Michael and Pam Brandt. And Pam Brandt had been in a group called the Deadly Nightshade. And she also had answered Mike's ad, and apparently they had a meeting or two previous to this. And so we all ordered Chinese food, and Mike made sorbet, and Pam went home, and I stayed.
Yes, Richard stayed, and they became partners. And, well, the band did get formed, with the addition of one more member, Jan Clary, and it lasted about 4 years, playing all sorts of venues and gay benefits, AIDS benefits, proms, and on and on. And they recorded one demo tape. You can hear the complete interview of Pam telling about the band Low Life on my March show, but I did want to share with you her talking about one special song.
Talk about his version, the irresistible version of Where the Boys Are.
Oh, that was so good. It still pops up in my head all the time. It's an old Connie Francis song. We heavily rearranged. It was really fun. But when a gay guy sings it, it becomes an entirely different thing. You know, Michael singing Where the Boys Are. And he would camp it up like crazy when he sang it, of course, and sing really high, much higher than Connie Francis ever sang. It was also a vehicle for Michael. He had a lifelong musical goal of holding a note as long as the longest note that Barbara Streisand ever held on a recording. So at the end of the song, that's exactly what he does. He holds, someone waits, and then he holds four, you know, before me. And he holds that four for 3 seconds longer than the longest note that Barbara Streisand ever recorded.
Smiling face.
Both of those songs were on the Low Life demo tape and also were remastered to the versions you just heard as they appeared on Michael's solo album, Purple Heart. Again, those interview excerpts come from my March show, and a lot more of the discussion of the band Low Life and a lot more music can be found there. But for this show, I have to move on to Michael's solo work. So I'm going back to Richard Dworkin to pick up the story and talk about what happened next, after the end of the band Low Life.
How we got from having a band Low Life to making a solo album was that Michael had AIDS from the time I knew him. And by 1986, I think it was 19, I can't remember now if it's 86 or 87 when we started recording. Anyway, I think it was a Nina Simone record. I had a record called Nina Simone and Piano. And I played it for Mike one day, and he said, you know, that's a really affecting and moving album, and it's just her and piano. So maybe we should just make a record, and it'll be whatever it'll be. Because, you know, Mike was very influenced by people like Barbara Streisand, Elton John, Bette Midler, who usually had big productions behind their voices. So he always wanted that kind of thing. And I think it was sort of him dealing with his own, imagining his imminent mortality and thinking, well, it's better that I make some record than not make any record. So we started looking for a place where we could make a record. And we were lucky to find Fred Hirsch, who had a studio in his loft at that time.
Chronologically, we're in about 1988 and Michael's Purple Heart album, and it contained his most acclaimed song, Love Don't Need a Reason.
Michael wrote this tune with Marcia Malamut, with whom he wrote several songs. It may have been the first tune that they wrote together. And they got the idea to write this song when Barbara Streisand announced that she was going to make a movie of Larry Kramer's play, The Normal Heart. And they thought, let's write a song that could be the theme song for that movie. Now, of course, it's what? That was in 1986. And, of course, that movie's never been made.
Still no movie.
Still no movie. But the song has been sung by a lot of people. It's there's, I don't know, maybe 15 commercial releases of versions of that song. So anyway, Mike and Marcia got the idea to write this song, and Marcia had written with Peter Allen. And it was Marcia's idea to invite Peter Allen to work on writing the song. And so the three of them wrote it, and it got its public debut at the New York City AIDS Walk, which still goes on in Central Park every May. Peter sang the song at the AIDS Walk in 1987.
All three of the writers, Michael, Marcia Malamut, and Peter Allen, recorded solo versions of the song, and it's by far his most covered song, done by many other artists and choruses over the years. So I especially wanted to hear from Michael's co-writer on the song, Marcia Malamut. She is a very acclaimed songwriter whose work has been recorded by, just to name a few, Barbra Streisand, Luther Vandross, Faith Hill, Diana Ross, Barbara Cook, Peter Allen, and on and on. When I wrote her, she said she always has time to talk about Michael.
How did you meet Michael, and when did you meet him?
Well, we both were singers back in New York in the 80s. I was a singer-songwriter, so is he. He knew me from a club that I used to perform in called Reno Sweeney's, which was a very famous cabaret club in Greenwich Village back then. And he bumps into me on Broadway one afternoon, and we start chatting. And he said, Marcia, I just got a call from Larry Kramer, who wrote The Normal Heart, and he wanted me to write a theme song for the play because he had heard that Barbra Streisand was interested in buying, you know, getting the rights. So Michael was very excited to and he said, well, let's collaborate. Let's write a song. I said, that is so cool. I would love to. And at just that time, I was writing with Peter Allen. So I said, Michael, I'm writing with Peter Allen now, and I thought maybe we could get him into the collaboration. The three of us could write it. And he was just over the moon. And that following week, we all got together and wrote Love Don't Need a Reason. That was the moment that Michael and I solidified our friendship. We had known each other, and I think, you know, we said hello in a club or something, but it was never sort of this acknowledgement. And right when he bumped into me that day, that was the beginning of our friendship and our songwriting.
Do you happen to know what year that was?
I think it could have been the end of 85, because we wrote it and it was debuted at the first AIDS walk in Lincoln Center in 86.
While we're talking with Marcia, I'm going to jump ahead a bit in our chronology to share with you a live version of the song, with Michael singing and introducing it in April of 1993 at the March on Washington for GOVT rights. It was essentially his last live performance, and he died on December 27th, 1993. And unfortunately, due to time constraints, I won't be able to play complete versions of many of the songs in this segment. I do want to remind that the song was inspired by the play The Normal Heart, and the lyrics start out, "If a heart always did what a normal heart should do."
What a sight. You're a sight for sore eyes. Being gay is the greatest gift I've ever been given, and I don't care who knows about it. I'm going to sing a song that I wrote with my major lesbian friend, Marcia Malamut, and the late Peter Allen. It's called Love Don't Need a Reason. What a normal heart should do. If you always play a part instead of being who you really are, then you might just miss the one who's standing there. So instead of passing by, show him that you care. Instead of asking why me and why you, why not we two? 'Cause love don't need a reason. Love don't always rhyme. And love is all we have for now. What we don't have is time. If we always believe all the madness that we're taught, never questioning the rules, then we're living lies we bought so long ago. How are they to know? It's not who's wrong or right, it's just another way. I don't wanna fight, but no, I'm gonna stay with you to the end, with you, my friend. 'Cause love don't need a reason, love don't always rhyme, and love is all we have for now. What we don't have is time. close. Time can't tear us apart. Forever I will stand by you. Oh, we've got to start with the beat of two hearts. Together we will see this through. Cause love don't need a reason. Love's never a crime. And love is all we have for now. What we don't have, what we don't have, is time. Tell
me about the writing of A Love Worth Fighting For.
It was all-encompassing, his AIDS diagnosis. That's what he lived for, to get the word out. You know, he was invited to speak to Congress. He was on many TV shows. I accompanied him on many of them. He was just the spokesman. It was a moment in time when Michael did his thing and did it very well. And he came up with an idea. You know, he thought that this was a fight, that we had to fight for our rights, that they were not going to be handed to us. And, of course, the bottom line to that is love. And he wanted to write a song about the fight, but also about two people, partners, that loved each other. And the inspiration of their love came out of this song and vice versa. That, you know, just look in my eyes. And that's the love that we're fighting for.
I believe that we can change the world. And the madness grows. There's so much pain and hate. It's all just fear, I suppose. I won't hide anymore. This time I can't ignore a love so right it shows. You know it deep inside, and now you must decide to speak what your heart knows. Isn't this love? Isn't this love? Isn't this love worth fighting for? Isn't this love? I know it's love for sure. This is a love worth fighting for.
The song was first released on the 1995 compilation A Love Worth Fighting For, which included a number of extraordinary artists, And on it, you can also hear Marsha's own version of Love Don't Need a Reason. And I know you've been waiting for this. It's time for the flirtations chapter of the story. First, I'm going to sneak in a surprise.
He's the man that's fit, and he knows a good fit. Fit for action, he's a jockey man. A trendsetter, he's a real go-getter. His style is fair, he's a jockey man. Taking it easy, taking it fast. He wears the brand that bumps her past. He's a hard driver. He's a jockey man, he's a jockey man. Jockey man. He's a jockey man.
Wouldn't you buy jockey underwear from Michael Callan? That was the plan, anyway. In 1982, he recorded a number of demos of commercials, hoping to get that kind of work. Okay, here's another.
Everybody needs energy to get ahead. Small wonder, wonderful weather's used. Wonder Bread.
Now, back to the flirtations, and for that, I go to founding member John Arterton.
How was the group The Flirtations formed?
I came out of the closet pretty late in life. I was, I think, 37 or maybe even 38, and I came out with Wild Abandon. And shortly after that, I got cast in a show called The 10% Review, Tom Wilson Weinberg show. And after a year and a half of doing that, the other guy was in the show, and I both left the show. And we lived in the same neighborhood in Brooklyn. And we were having breakfast one day, and we both said, boy, it would be great to have a singing group. And so we came up with the idea of the Flirts, and we put up notices around Greenwich Village and posted advertisements in the gay newspapers at the time. And people came out and auditioned, and we started. That was the fall of 1987. We had just come to the March on Washington, and went home very enthused and wanting to do something.
Right. And that was Elliot Pilshaw, wasn't it?
Yes. Yep.
So who were the first, quote-unquote, official members of the group?
We actually started with six. We were Elliot and I and Michael and Aurelio and T.J. Myers and Cal Grogan. And after about a year, maybe less than a year, Cal left the group. And maybe a year and a half, 2 years in, Elliot decided that he wanted to leave the group. He had just gotten a new job in New York and had just gotten a new boyfriend, and he didn't want to be on the road. And so that's when Cliff joined the group.
How soon after the formation did the group start touring?
I would say it was at least a year before we did much. Remember, our first out of New York City concert was up in Poughkeepsie, and that was probably 1988, I would say, probably in the fall. But it wasn't long after that, and of course, we released our first album in, I think, 89.
There's a YouTube video of the group from 1988 singing on the streets the song My Boyfriend's Back. Was that the first audio or video capture of the group?
You know, I don't know. That very well might be. As far as I know, that's the earliest footage.
Well, I love that clip because y'all were singing My Boyfriend's Back, which you never recorded on your own.
I guess you're right, yeah.
So this is a historic recording, caught live on the street, with street noise, but I just have to share some of it.
He went away, you hung around, bothered me every night. Uh-huh. And when I wouldn't go out with you, you said some things that were very nice.
Oh.
My boyfriend's back and you're gonna be in trouble.
When you
see him coming, better cut out on the double.
Hey, la, hey, la, my boyfriend's back.
But you've been spreading lies that I was untrue.
Hey, la, hey, la, my boyfriend's back.
So look out now, cause he's coming after you.
Hey, la, my
got my friends back. Hey, he knows what you've been trying. Hey, he knows what you've been lying. What made you think he'd believe all your lies?
Wait,
you're a big man now, but it cut you down to size. Wait and see. My boyfriend's back, he's gonna save my reputation.
Hey, love, hey, love, my boyfriend's back.
If I was you, I'd take a permanent vacation.
Hey, love, my boyfriend's back. Hey,
my boyfriend's back.
Hey, look at my
boyfriend's back. My boyfriend's back.
What would you say were one or two of the career highlights for the group?
Well, obviously being in the film Philadelphia was one of the big highlights, I would say. The opening ceremony of the Gay Games in Yankee Stadium was also a thrill. We once got to be the guest artists of the New York City Gay Men's Chorus in Carnegie Hall. That, of course, was a thrill. There were many. Almost every city I have some kind of memory of.
In the film Philadelphia, the group sang Mr. Sandman. Talk about your version of that and how was it picked for the movie?
We actually were playing a concert in Philadelphia, and somebody on Jonathan Demme's crew saw the poster for our concert on a street corner, and he brought it in and gave it to the producer, and the producer called me up and said, if you got any music you could send me. And I said, well, I've got a CD, you know. And he went, oh, yeah, well, I didn't know you had a... So I sent him the CD, and I suspect that he listened to the songs on the CD and picked that one out.
And it's a very campy version.
Yes, yeah, we had a lot of fun writing the words to that song.
From the second Flirtation CD, Live Out on the Road, from 1992, is Mr. Sandman.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest boy that I've ever seen. Give him two lips like roses in clover. Then tell me that my lonesome nights are over, Mr. Sandman. I'm so alone. Don't have a boyfriend to call my own. Please turn on your magic beam, Mr. Sandman. Bring us a dream.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream.
Please make him gargle and brush with glee. Give him a lonely heart like Pagliacci, but not as closeted as Liberace.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a heap.
Give him a basket of flowers for me.
Please turn on your magic beam.
Sandman, bring us, please, please bring us, Mr. Sandman, bring us a dream.
In addition to many humorous songs in their performances, they were even more known for a couple songs that were very inspirational.
Talk about the song, Something Inside So Strong.
When I had a boyfriend in New York very early on in our relationship, he said, you know, I know this song that would be great for you guys. And I said, oh, well, you know, I should just tell you that there are some songs that lend themselves and others that don't. So, you know, a lot of people have suggested songs and they haven't worked out. So I'd love to hear it, but, you know, I can't promise anything. and he played me the original version of La Bicifera, singing that song. And I was just blown away.
Mm-hmm.
Just, I don't know if you've heard, have you heard the original?
Yep, yep.
Yeah, it's intense. So we arranged it, and we just started doing it. It's an amazing, just an amazing song. The, for one thing, the rhythmic drive that it has, it's difficult in writing a cappella arrangement sometimes to capture the rhythmic intensity of a song, but that one seems to work pretty well a cappella.
The higher you build your barrier, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, there's something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong.
Brothers and sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough,
not good enough.
What do we do then? We'll look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway.
Say, we're gonna do it anyway.
Say, we're gonna do it anyway.
Say,
we're gonna do it anyway.
God says, something inside so strong.
Oh,
I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone.
Oh no,
oh no,
there's something inside so strong.
Oh
no, something inside so strong.
Something inside so strong.
Something inside, something inside, something inside.
There's something so strong.
The Flirtations, and a shortened version of Something Inside So Strong.
What would you like the world to know about Michael Callan?
Well, he would want me to say that he was a big old queen. He was a unique, amazing person, very kind, loving, sensitive, creative, determined person who just believed that he could. And he worked so well with people that he inspired them to greater deeds. I think everyone who came into contact with Michael in any sizable way is grateful for the gift of having been a part of his life. There are not many people that one meets along the journey that stay with you the way Michael has with me and a lot of people. Just an amazing, inspiring human being.
Michael died on December 27, 1993. His last live performance was at the March on Washington in April of that year. There's video on YouTube of him singing Love Don't Need a Reason at that event. I played the audio of that earlier in this segment. While he was no longer strong enough to tour with the Flirts, he was definitely able to record music. And from January through September of that year, he and Richard Dworkin went into the studio and captured about 40 songs, all sung masterfully. In 1996, the result was the release of a double CD that I consider at the top of the list of essential LGBT recordings for any music collection. It was called Legacy, and included 29 songs of a variety of styles, and many of them iconic to me, like the ones already discussed with Marsha Malamet. There are way too many to cover in this segment, so for eager listeners, it is fortunate that this tribute has additional parts to feature much more of Michael's music. One of those songs first appeared in 1990, but was redone beautifully for the Legacy album. It was called Crazy World, and Richard Dworkin commented on it.
Crazy World. I would love it if someone sort of put a little EQ on it so it sounded like it was coming out of a mono transistor radio or something. I always imagine that song as like, this is from a lounge singer in the 50s that no one ever heard of, you know, and he made this gay song and it never got released. Crazy World, Mike had written and recorded for a compilation, Feeding the Flame, Songs by Men to End AIDS, I believe is the name of the compilation. He had recorded it just with his own piano accompaniment. But at some point I got the idea that it would sound good as a 6/8 ballad, and that's how we did it.
Where boy gets boy and girl gets girl, it seems to me we're all just victims of anatomy. Can't they see we live in a crazy world? I'm so lonely, I feel like the only one who ever felt this way. I could deceive them, but I'll never believe them, no matter what other people say. I'm gonna stay with you, even in this crazy world. They're always saying this world needs more love, but somehow not our kind. It makes no sense how they pick and choose. Could use more love, however find it. Then I'm reminded, hey, we live in a crazy world.
As we near the end of this tribute, I have something that helps prove the legacy continues. There is a musical in New York City currently in development about the life and work of Michael Callan. It's called Even for One Night, and was conceived and written by Jim Bredesen, and I was able to talk with him about what inspired the show.
I had borrowed a compact disc recording of the 1986 version of Sweet Charity, and the person who loaned it to me, underneath that disc in the case, was a copy of Purple Heart. And so I got home and I put on that disc first, and fell in love with Michael Callan. I was 18 at the time, and his music was really speaking to me. I didn't know anything else about him, but I had put that recording away and forgot all about him until 2011, when I rediscovered him. It kind of opened a Pandora's box where I Googled as much as I could, and then I realized that Richard Dworkin lived 20 blocks from me. So I reached out to Richard, and he and I struck up quite a friendship that really has become a research project that I enjoy immensely.
And how did that turn into a show?
Sure. You know, I approached him with the idea. I think that my initial email was, you know, I'd like to look at Michael's life and his music as a theater project. And Richard was like, okay, sure, go for it. You know, mainly because I think he's gotten calls like this before. In fact, I know he has. Because this material is rich, and a lot of people know it, but I'm not sure that anybody's actually really followed up on an initial idea. But looking at the material and looking at the music and also this great vault that Michael left behind. He came at a time when the video camera was new, as you know. Recording and audio cassettes were cheap. Answering machines were cheap. People left many drafts of their writing because the computer had become so popular. And so much of Michael in a first person had been left behind that I started to look at the idea of, well, what if we let Michael tell his own story? What if we look at the best of the best of how he expressed himself, his beliefs, and told his own story, and somehow wove that together into an evening of experience with Michael, rather than something that's a more standard book musical?
So how is it staged?
So we have five actors who are all playing Michael simultaneously. They are talking to each other, commenting on each other's thoughts, rephrasing each other's thoughts, and kind of trying to exemplify the many different types of Michaels that there were. And so what you have is a conversation between Michael Callan, a singer-songwriter, Michael Callan, an AIDS activist, Michael Callan, a sex-positive person, all of these voices together at one time telling a story. So we have five actors, one of whom plays the piano in performance, telling the story together.
Do they all sing?
They all sing, yes. One of these archetypes, if you will, or types of Michael, is the most artistic of them, or the one who is the singer-songwriter, the one who doesn't want to talk about condom use but wants to make music. He does the majority of the singing.
This is J.D. Doyle, and I'm winding down my Michael Callan tribute. I did quite a bit of researching and interviewing for the show, and in my usual zeal, captured much more than would fit into an hour segment. So there are more parts to the show where I will have more of many of my interviews, a whole lot more music, including a song from Jim Bredesen's musical, and a couple rare surprises. That's on my website at queermusicheritage.com. I adore Michael's body of work so much that I struggled with what song should close the show. I consider two iconic ones, They Are Falling All Around Us and Healing Power of Love. But finally chose one of the most famous has done by the Flirtations. It is the Fred Small song, Everything Possible, and I asked John Arterton to talk about it. I'm thinking you greatly respect the song, Everything Possible, as do I. When Michael was in the Flirts, it was recorded twice, and you've done it two more times, on the third Flirt CD and on your own CD with your husband James Mack. Talk about how that song went over when the Flirts sang it in concert.
I'd be glad to. Well, you know, there are really two major songs that we did that had a huge impact, and that was one of them, and Something Inside So Strong was the other. Everything Possible. I can't tell you how many people came up after concerts and just told us what it meant to them to hear that song and the sentiments in it. It was kind of our 1-2 punch to end the show. We would sing Everything Possible, and then we would sing Something Inside So Strong. And through the years, we thought about trying other songs in those positions, and nothing seemed to work.
No, you can't top well. Those two songs.
No, you can't. But I think when we were going to put Everything Possible onto the third album, I called Fred Small to tell him, and he said, well, you know, I do write other songs. You know, I think we can really be proud of the fact that after we sang that song and recorded it, that virtually every gay and lesbian chorus across the country started singing it. And, I mean, we did not write the song. Fred Small wrote the song, you know.
I consider this song so important to the story that I also contacted the songwriter, Fred Small, to ask about the inspiration for Everything Possible.
I was on tour in the Pacific Northwest in, I think, the winter of 1983, and I was staying in the home of Janet Peterson, who is a cellist and singer with the women's group Motherlode. And she and I were talking, and she was telling me about her son, who was then 9 years old, and how he was struggling in school because of all the expectations and pressure and gender stereotyping around being a boy. You know, he'd just been a kid, and suddenly he realized there were all these norms that he had to uphold as a guy, that he had to distinguish himself from girls by being different. And the difference was not a difference that he found very helpful or natural to him. And Janet said something like, "Well, Fred, I'm going to make the same request of you that I'm making to every songwriter who passes through Seattle. And can you write a song that can support my son in knowing that he has choices, that he doesn't have to fit these stereotypes?" I don't recall how I responded, but within 24 hours, I think I was working on Everything Possible, and I'm pretty sure I wrote it on the bus to Olympia, Washington, on the way to a gig. But that was the genesis of the song. At some point, Elliot Pilshaw heard the song and brought it to the Flirtations, with whom he was singing at the time. And they arranged it for their five a cappella voices and began to sing it as part of their repertoire. And my understanding is that it became their most requested song. I think they recorded it on three different albums over the years. And they, of course, brought it to a completely different and ultimately much larger audience of, you know, gay and lesbian choruses and their audiences around the world. I mean, in those days you didn't talk about things going viral, but certainly the Flirts vastly expanded the audience for the song.
This is maybe an unfair question. Do you have a favorite recording of the song?
Oh, I'd have to say the Flirts, you know, with Michael singing. It's just stunning.
We have cleared off the table, the leftovers saved, washed the dishes and put them away. I have told you a story and tucked you in tight at the end of your knockabout day. As the moon sets its sail to carry you to sleep over the midnight sea, well, I will sing you a song no one sang to me. May it keep you good company. You can be anybody that you want to be. You can love whomever you will. You can travel any country where your heart leads. And know I will love you still. You can live by yourself. You can gather friends around. You can choose one special one. And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone.
Some girls grow up strong and bold. Some boys are quiet and kind.
Some race on ahead, some follow behind.
Some grow in their own space and time.
Some women love women.
And some men love men.
Some raise children and some never do.
You can dream
of a day never reaching the end of everything possible. for you.
Don't be rattled by names, by taunts or games, but seek out
spirits true.
If you give your friends the best part of yourself, they will give the same back to you.
You can be anybody that you want to be. You can love whomever you will. You can travel any country where your heart leads. And oh, I will love you still. You can live by yourself. You can gather friends around. You can choose one special one. And the only measure of your words and your deeds will be the love you leave behind when you're gone.
Oh, the love you leave.